Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We're revisiting why we chose careers in service and what that says about us, about our families, and about our communities. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Matthew Tejada. As the chief visionary and strategist for NRDC's advocacy to protect human health, Matthew Tejada oversees NRDC's clean air, water, toxics, and climate adaptation program. He is also responsible for leading the team, structures, partnerships, and policy initiatives needed to tackle major health threats facing communities. Prior to joining NRDC, Tejada served as the Deputy Assistant Administrator for Environmental Justice within the U.S. EPA, Office for Environmental Justice and External Civil Rights. In his 10-plus years with the EPA as DAA for EJ and prior to that, Director of the Office of Environmental Justice, Tejada led all aspects of environmental justice work throughout the agency and in coordination with other federal agencies, states, tribes, and local governments. His background also includes teaching English as a foreign language within the U.S. Peace Corps in Bulgaria. So thank you so much for being here with me today. I'm really excited to talk with you.
Thanks for having me on, Kate. I'm excited to talk with you as well.
Of course. So let's just dive right in. Who or what in your life kind of shaped your worldview and your value system and led to this path of service for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's... I've had kind of a meandering path to get to where I eventually settled out in advocacy work and at the EPA as well. It really started though, kind of where I was raised, like a lot of folks. And I had, I guess, somewhat of a unique upbringing in that I kind of was part of different worlds growing up. My brothers and I, we're the only part of our family really that was born and raised in Texas. Almost all the rest of our family was in northern New Mexico, and that's kind of our familial homeland. And my brothers and I all have real strong connections to northern New Mexico, but we never lived there full time, and the rest of our family was. We were born and raised in a fairly low income, predominantly community of color, kind of on the outskirts of Fort Worth. We were on the side of, you know, one of those lakes, one of the thousands of lakes that have been built in Texas, primarily for either water or a power plant. And in this one, we lived on the side of the lake where there was a power plant, and you couldn't really access the lake. You couldn't really access almost any sort of, you know, natural resources or just a clean environment in the part of Fort Worth where we grew up in. And then halfway through our childhood, we moved to the other side of that lake. We moved to the suburb. Where it was like, you know, the complete opposite of where we'd been growing up. I went from being one of three white kids in my elementary class to being, to having an elementary class that had like three or four black kids in it. You know, a lot more wealth, you know, a lot of access to things. I could walk to the lake whenever I wanted to and go fishing whenever I wanted to when we moved. It was just a completely different world. And I think growing up, you know, in between those three worlds, I just had a real sense that they were different and that there were stark unfairnesses that existed, especially just, you know, moving what was really only 2 or 3 miles as the crow flies, but just moving to a completely different part of our society. I just had this real sense that things were unfair and I didn't know why. So I kind of set out through school and then until I finally, you know, found my first, you know, kind of adult job. You know, it was kind of a long time of just looking for what I could do about that unfairness in our society and in our country.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think a lot of our listeners and certainly a lot of the people that I've talked with as a part of this project relate to some element of that, kind of some early experience where they identify a gap or something that they think requires their attention and they've tried to look for ways that they could be a part of that solution. So then how did you end up joining the Peace Corps?
I was in an undergraduate at University of Texas. I still didn't know what I wanted to study at that point. A lot of folks kept saying I should be a lawyer, and for some reason that just didn't feel like the right fit for me. So, but I did English and Spanish undergraduate, and then was graduating, and I knew I wasn't done with school. But I also knew that I was not going to continue with English. Like, there was no way I was going to get a graduate degree in English. So I really just didn't know, you know, what I wanted to do, and was kind of foundering, and didn't have a plan. And one day at the University of Texas, which at that time was the biggest school in the United States, in two different classes on the same day, in two completely different, different parts of the campus, like two classes I had that were like a mile away from each other, the same two Peace Corps recruiters happened to pop into those two classrooms, which was like I don't know what the odds were, like one in a million is what it felt like. It's like, why are these two Peace Corps people? How did they come into my classes twice in one day? So I went by their table later that afternoon. It was out on the West Mall on campus in Austin, and just talked to some more of the recruiters and got the literature, the paper information. And it just started to kind of grow on me, this idea of serving, of volunteering. I'd been volunteering at that point. I used to be a big brother, big sister while I was an undergraduate. And so this was another volunteer opportunity, but it was one, you know, that would get me out of the country, which was exciting. I'd never left the country at that point, except, you know, crossing the border into Mexico here and there. You know, getting to learn another language in addition to Spanish was really intriguing and exciting to me. So it just seemed like a really cool and exciting opportunity. And I'm a huge booster for the Peace Corps now. I think a lot of folks in the United States don't appreciate the privilege we have had of having an institution like the Peace Corps, right? Where you can volunteer, you can serve in different places around the world, you can bring that service back to the United States. It is such an incredible opportunity that we have. And the Peace Corps really wound up being, you know, very formative for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I imagine that it was. And so how do you think that the things that you experienced in the Peace Corps kind of contributed to growing those early seeds that were planted in your mind from the way that you grew up about health and justice and environment?
I mean, it wasn't really in the Peace Corps yet. I mean, the Peace Corps, it got me connected more to other individuals who were serving in the Peace Corps, and kind of exposed me to, you know, economics, to international relations, to politics and government, you know, seeing how a different society was operating. At that time, you know, Bulgaria was still only about 10 years post-communism and their democratic transition. So just seeing all of those things happening, you know, when I was still really young, I was on a plane leaving the United States to Bulgaria 2 weeks after I graduated undergraduate. So it was just this, it was so much just, you know, new experiences and learning and opportunities. But that's where I really, while I was in the Peace Corps, I was like, well, now I think I know what I want to study. I want to study, I want to study these things. I want to study why governments behave the way they do. I want to study relations and policy and, you know, politics. So started applying to graduate schools and wound up doing a Russian East European studies course, which gave me the opportunity to study a lot of those different things, IR and the econ and policy and everything, but allowed me to focus back in on Bulgaria. And that's really what kind of then clued me in. It was some of the research stuff that I started to pursue when I was doing a master's and then a PhD. It really led me to the career that I wound up pursuing once I came back to the United States.
And then, so most of my guests have pursued careers with the State Department, with USAID. You ended up joining the EPA. Can you talk a little bit more about what led you in that direction and made you want to focus on environment and a domestic agency?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I came back to the United States after I'd lived in Europe at that point for 6 years between the Peace Corps and graduate school. And it was during my research, I wound up doing a lot of my research for my dissertations with just a bunch of environmental activists in Bulgaria, you know, folks that had fought against the communist government. They were dissidents against the communist government. The folks that were there, you know, in the first days of democracy and the formation of democracy in their country in late 1989, in the early 90s. And they had really started to organize and started to activate around issues of health and protecting their families and protecting their communities in a system where they didn't have any power to do that. And so they had this big drive, you know, to tear that system down and to create a democratic system where their voices could be heard and they could have some ability to actually protect themselves and their communities and their families. So that I knew that's what I wanted to do when I came back to the United States. I had no idea how to do it. I mean, I looked at the EPA when I first came back and I kept looking at the sorts of positions they had at EPA. And I was like, I don't qualify for any of those. I had a master's in Russian East European Studies and a PhD in history. And I was like, I don't qualify for anything. What
you're
am I going to do?
You're the obvious candidate.
Obvious,
right?
EPA was just calling my name at that point. So it took me close to a year. And I finally got on with an advocacy in Austin, Texas again. A public interest research group, a PIRG, which I'm sure a lot of folks probably that listen have come through the PIRG. The PIRG is a big seeding ground for a lot of public servants. But it was while I was serving in that PIRG in Austin, I was noticed by the board members of this organization in Houston that worked on air quality issues, worked on public health, had been founded back in the 80s by just a bunch of civic leaders, by just a bunch of community members who were struggling with pollution in and around the Houston area, and nobody was doing that much about it. So they started to get organized, and they created this organization. And then, you know, 25 years later or whatever, it was kind of struggling. And so these board members, they saw me speak at a thing and are like, well, you know, maybe that person can come be our executive director of this organization, because otherwise it was about to shut down. And so they hired me. I agreed to move to Houston, and they hired me to run this organization, which at the time was called the Galveston Houston Association for Smog Prevention. And through the course of about 6 years, you know, despite the Great Recession and our office was completely demolished by Hurricane Ike and, you know, a lot of setbacks mm-hmm. early on, we managed to not only turn the organization around and rebuild it. We rebranded it as Air Alliance Houston. It's still down in Houston, doing absolutely phenomenal work around Houston in the Gulf Coast area, but turned it around, rebuilt it, started growing it and attracting new funding for it and opening up new lines of work, but also took it back to its grassroots. Started doing a lot of community organizing, started doing a lot of just straight up environmental justice work, community science work, lobbying and litigating. I mean, kind of the whole suite of advocacy. And that got me noticed early on by some of the folks who came into EPA when President Obama was elected. And Lisa Jackson, who was President Obama's first administrator, she came into EPA and really wanted to focus on environmental justice. It was one of her biggest priorities. But she and her team, including Lisa Garcia, who was EPA's first ever EJ advisor, they wanted to rebuild the Office of Environmental Justice, and they wanted somebody who had proven that they could turn an organization around, while also, you know, operating from that kind of grassroots perspective, you know, operating really from that base of having worked at the community level. And so it wound up, somebody in Dallas in the Dallas EPA office, you know, called the folks in headquarters in DC and was like, hey, there's this kid down in Houston. He's running this thing called Air Alliance Houston, but he's pretty interesting. Y'all should give him a look. And so I just kept getting these officials from headquarters, from EPA headquarters, kept coming to Houston, you know, and just, you know, calling me ahead of time, like they wanted to spend a whole day with me just doing a tour of the ship channel and seeing the port operations. And so I kept taking these day long trips with these EPA officials from DC. And I didn't really think anything of it, but they were kind of vetting me, I think, ahead of time. They were checking me out, spending some time with me. And that led to my awareness of this position at EPA to kind of rebuild the EJ program. And after, you know, applying and some time of going through the application process, wound up finally going to EPA and getting the job to be the director of the Office of Environmental Justice back in 2013.
So that's amazing. So finally, the EPA came calling after you had searched their website and not found your match early on. You ended up kind of where you were meant to be. So for people who are not as familiar with environmental justice and with the link between environmental justice and national security, would you be willing to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, there are a lot of linkages, not only domestically, but internationally. And one of the things to understand is that, to me, there's different ways you can kind of explain environmental justice to people. One of the ways, though, that I've always found effective is power, which to me kind of gets to the most basic part of equity and justice work. In any society, there have been communities that do not have the power to protect themselves from bad things and to attract the good things that we all want in our community, like having access to green space and natural resources. So in the United States, that power has typically, or that lack of power has typically been experienced by communities of color, Black and brown communities, and indigenous communities. But it's also been a function of class and lower income communities, low income white communities, particularly rural low income mm-hmm. white communities, have also lacked the power to protect themselves and to attract the good things that we all want in our communities. So that has been kind of the locus of environmental justice in the United States. And the purpose of the program is to lift up the voices of folks from those communities, to highlight the fact that there are huge disparities in terms of public health outcomes, in terms of wealth accumulation and retention, in terms of just lifespan. Of people that live in what we quote unquote call EJ communities. And that has caused a real disparity in our society and in our government. It's a huge vulnerability that we have so many communities that are experiencing excessive vulnerability or susceptibility to any sort of threat, whether it's pollution or the changing climate or economic instability, and that is an issue for our society overall. That we have such huge swaths of people that are a part of our broader community in the United States who experience that sort of vulnerability and who have been dumped on very purposefully for mm-hmm. a very long time, and made to be sick and had their wealth extracted from their communities. So from a security standpoint, from just a, you know, the strength of our society will never be as strong as it could be until we address, those histories of oppression that have been visited on, you know, communities of color and low income communities, and really do the equity work of closing those disparities, closing up those gaps in protection and in wealth and in resilience of those communities, so that overall our entire society would be stronger.
Yeah, and it's a part of the proof of concept, right, of our great experiment of our democracy, and we have to make it work to be able to then demonstrate that it can work in other contexts.
Yeah, one of the things that can be a little tricky to talk about sometimes in equity and justice work is that idea of equality. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of folks equate equality with fairness, kind of going back to, you know, my experience as a child experiencing unfairness. And equality is, you know, that bedrock idea of our country. It's kind of the word that gave our country its existence, but we've never had equality in our country, mm-hmm. whether you look at gender, whether you look at race, whether you look at socioeconomic status, we've never had equality in our country. Mm-hmm. And to do so requires that we recognize these histories of inequality and that we practice equity and justice. Right. We practice equity to bring everyone forward to the same level of enjoyment of benefits, to the same level of protection, whether it's from pollution or from the changing climate or even just, you know, violence or other threats. And that we also practice justice, recognizing that many things in the government have led to these inequities, and we have to change those systems and structures to be more just. And if we can do that, if we can practice equity and justice, you know, that is the only way that one day we have a chance in our country of actually achieving equality.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was actually going to ask you, you may have already answered this completely, but what other misconceptions you think there might be about the work that you've done, the work that you continue to do? And I think you really did just hit on one of them, which is the idea that there's no need to kind of go back and address all the historical facets of inequality that are also contributing to the continuous oppression of certain groups in our country.
Right.
What else?
I mean, one of them is, and this is something that's really being abused to a great extent currently, mm-hmm. it's this idea that, you know, somebody's doing something special for somebody else,
yeah.
and that's going to leave somebody else behind, which is, I think, a very purposeful misleading of folks. Equity and justice is not about doing something special for Black and Brown communities and low-income white communities and the indigenous communities and others. It is about doing the thing for them that everyone else has already received. Mm-hmm. It is about catching them up to the place where so many other communities already enjoy protection. Don't have to worry about the water that comes out of their tap when they turn it on in the morning to pour a cup of water for, mm-hmm. for their kids, right? They don't have to worry about their kids going out, you know, into the front yard or onto the playground and you know, getting contaminated with toxic stuff that is in the ground. They don't have to worry about going outside and inhaling pollution that is going to bring on an asthma attack, or that, you know, 20 years from now is going to bring about some sort of some funky cancer or some other sort of ailment to either themselves or their future generations. There's, you know, most of us in our day-to-day lives, we don't worry about those things.
Right.
But there are a lot of communities that do.
Right.
And until we have provided those communities with what they need and really prioritize their needs first, to bring them up to the same level of protection, the same level of benefit that the rest of us take for granted, frankly, then we just have a society of inequality. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times when you explain it that way to folks, you know, folks that might have kind of a fairness reaction to, well, that's unfair, right? Why don't I get my needs prioritized? If you can explain it, well, your needs have been prioritized, and your needs are not the same as the very acute needs of folks whose needs haven't been prioritized. It helps them understand that this is something that is not just right for us to do, but helps our entire society, our entire country be a better, stronger place that gets closer to that ideal of equality.
Absolutely. And basically, it's not about equality of outcomes necessarily, but about everybody having the same raw material for a good life, the same opportunity for a good life.
Yeah, and being treated the way that we all mm-hmm. deserve and demand by our government and
Golden
by our
rule.
Public institutions. Yeah.
Golden rule. Okay, so shifting gears, who do you admire? Because I think that your work is so admirable, and I'm sure that there are people that you have looked up to inspire you as well. So who do you admire?
That's a great question. I mean, for me, especially just coming up doing this work in Houston and around Texas, kind of my understanding of it and kind of the horizon in front of me really opening up didn't start to until I kind of got out of Houston a little bit, and mm-hmm. I got around some of the other environmental justice leaders in other parts of the country. So, you know, more close to Houston, one of the early individuals I encountered and who really just his passion and his commitment and his persistence fighting for his community in West Port Arthur was Hilton Kelly. Mm-hmm. And Hilton Kelly's still down there. He's got an amazing story about just his, you know, his own life and career, but coming back home and kind of, you know, having a kind of confronting himself with, you know, needing to move home to fight for his community. Because after he had left, and I'm telling his story for him now, so I'm going to stop doing it here in a minute. But after he had left, you know, and he gained that perspective of having lived somewhere else and then going home to be like, whoa, you know, somebody really needs to fight for where I grew up. So Hilton Kelly was always a big influence on me, and kind of in the same way in other parts, you know, one of the things that we started doing when I was rebuilding Air Alliance Houston, cause it had been so focused on, you know, refineries and chemical plants and petrochemical plants, which it should, and it still is, but we also needed to start working on ports issues and goods movement and trucking and trains, because those are a huge source of pollution in places like the Houston area. So we started traveling out to California to kind of broaden our horizons. And I've met for the first time Margaret Gordon from the West Oakland Environmental Indicators Project. Who's a long time just warrior for her community of West Oakland, fighting goods movement, pollution from ships and trucks, and using science and using government systems in such an effective way. So her and then other folks like down in Southern California, folks like Angela Logan, who's working for East Yards for Communities for Environmental Justice, and then helped create this huge nationwide coalition of community leaders that work on goods movement called the Moving Forward Network. Now, he was part of the creation of it. A lot of folks helped. But yeah, just that exposure kind of early on in my career of other folks that were, you know, just out there dedicating their lives to fighting mm-hmm. for their communities, and doing that day in and day out, despite the challenges, despite, you know, losing way more than you're going to win. But just going back to it day in, day again, because it's the only way, you know, to really make change happen. Those sorts of leaders were just a huge inspiration to me early on in my career.
Yeah, I can imagine. So then you're already kind of leading in this direction, but thinking about service kind of broadly defined, how do you think about service now, particularly in a moment where many people are still serving in the capacity they've been in with the federal government? Some are probably losing the ability to serve in those capacities. Some are choosing to go to other places. What is your advice or kind of your call to action for people who want to continue to serve but might not find that the place they've been is the ideal scenario for them anymore?
Yeah, it's a really tough question. And I talk constantly with, you know, my former colleagues and my former staff, you know, all of whom I count as friends. You know, a lot of people right now in this administration in these times are facing choices that, you know, a few years ago, I don't think any of us would have imagined would be real choices or real situations. And there's nothing, you know, you can't look sideways at any decision that anyone makes today. But we, I guess, let me start with this. A lot of folks in the environmental advocacy space have been very concerned about the policy changes and the assault on regulations and rules, the assault on, you know, science and scientific processes and data. And those are all very, of course, very valid concerns. They are things that are going to take a lot of work to rebuild, not just, you know, those scientific processes and data, but the trust of the public mm-hmm. in science. You know, the sort of setbacks we're seeing on the policy front as programs and rules get turned around or frozen. We're losing time to really improve people's health. We're losing time to answer the challenge of all of our history on our changing climate. But the thing that I've been most concerned about as we witness this all-out assault on our government, are the people, you know, the actual civil servants inside. You know, unfortunately, you know, policies getting pushed back and forth and back and forth, that's become a pretty regular pattern in our society for the last 20 years. It's not good. It's not healthy. It's not helpful. You know, but we push them one way and then they get pushed back the other way for 4 years and we push them back the other way for another 4 years. You know, the attacks on science are going to take some time to get over. But as we lose so much accumulated experience, knowledge, passion, and commitment from so many civil servants who are leaving government one way or another, and doing so quickly and in such a brutal fashion, rebuilding that civil service and being able, you know, hopefully to attract folks to come back to it, hopefully being able to attract a next generation that you're always going to need to that civil service. It's going to be a huge challenge. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be the thing that is hardest to rebuild and recover from. I think this is a generational setback to our government because we are hollowing out the civil service. We are, you know, offering people such horrible choices about a future where they would be civil servants. And to all that, and what I've, you know, told to my friends and former colleagues and staff is nobody's going to judge you for staying in, despite, you know, the sort of odds that are going to be stacked against you while you stay in. We need people to stay in. And if people can't, if people need to, you know, they got to move on. They got to get out of there. You know, everyone will completely understand that. To the folks who are still civil servants and are able to hold on, stay in and stay true to their oath to uphold the Constitution and keep doing their jobs every day to serve the American people. You know, those folks are heroes and they should be celebrated and supported. And hopefully none of them should think, you know, 2 seconds about somebody thinking badly about them for staying in.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's like a mic drop moment because you just summarized the point of this whole project is helping people. First of all, it's therapy for public servants to get to come on here and talk about their experience.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes the value is in just telling the story because it's the truth. And in addition to that, to let people who are less familiar with public service understand who the people are kind of behind these job titles that we hear about or these offices that are being cut. And as you mentioned before, it's crucial not only that we can attract people into careers of service, but also rebuild the public trust in public servants. And I hope that I can do my small part in achieving that by featuring people like you who are so thoughtful, so honest, and so inspirational. And so I just want to thank you for joining me. It's been a pleasure getting to know you a bit better. And I also want to thank you for your service in so many capacities throughout your career.
Oh, thanks, Kate. I appreciate that. I was super happy to be a part of this because, you know, I see the real value and need for what you're doing with getting these stories out there and, you know, letting people to share their experiences, but also hopefully communicating to more and more folks just how important the people inside of our government are and how necessary the jobs they do are just to keep our society together and pointed in the right direction to one day be a society that everyone feels a part of.
One day at a time. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kate.